This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SubChina. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and I think we should abolish, eliminate, and do away with redundancy. My co-host is John Passon, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and told me he's been off his OCD meds for 7 months, 12 days, 3 hours, and 52 minutes. The ultra-traditional, the buddy, the know-it-all, and the two nice teachers, we're going to talk about why you should avoid them, but also highlight some of their redeeming qualities. Interviews with Brad Johnson, whose interest in friendships were the driving force to improving his Chinese skills to the level where he now hosts a podcast in Chinese. Let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hi everybody, I am John Paz and I am feeling warm this summer in Shanghai. It is a warm summer.
Especially warm. We do have some warm temperatures over here as well, but it's cooling down a little bit. Hey, there's a light at the end of the tunnel or... at least an ice cube or something, I don't know. Well, today we are going to be talking about the different types of Chinese teachers.
Yeah.
Specifically, the types of teachers to avoid.
Yeah, so I think we all know that there are some awesome teachers out there. We've given quite a few shout-outs to amazing Chinese teachers. But there are also some teachers where maybe they're not exactly perfect. Maybe they're a little frustrating to certain types of students. Maybe they're a little behind the times when it comes to their teaching approaches.
Exactly. So for all you great teachers out there, this is not a criticism at all. So all right, this is just more of, and even I would say, John, even some of those, I would say, quote unquote, maybe bad teachers to avoid, there's also some good things about them too.
Right. So this is just some food for thought for you people out there that are trying to find teachers. Maybe you feel like there's something off about your teacher and you can't put your finger on it. This might help you.
And John, I should also say this is a little congruent to a podcast we had a few episodes ago about the 6 types of Chinese learners. So we, which is episode number 87, we have here 4 main types of Chinese teachers to avoid.
Okay, so let's get into it. Number 1 is the super traditional teacher. So, this teacher might be old, bit of a dinosaur, not always. But the point is they equate teaching to learning. They expect you to take notes and remember everything.
Yes, these teachers are traditionally trying to teach you Chinese the way that they learned Chinese when they were younger.
Right, the whole treating foreign learners kind of like Chinese children. There are important differences in native and non-native, speakers of Chinese, and some teachers don't really give that a whole lot of consideration.
So here are some of the key characteristics of these types of teachers. Handwriting is a real big deal for these types of teachers.
Yeah, so if you've listened to some of our recent podcasts, like number 79, why typing characters is better than handwriting, then you might know that we're not huge fans of handwriting. It can be a good thing, but it's not absolutely necessary nowadays. But some teachers do not like that idea at all.
So an indicator of this is that if you are having class or a study session or a tutor session with a teacher who is like this, they're probably giving you 5, 7, 10 characters, new characters to quote unquote learn. And as part of your homework and assignment, they expect you to fill up these notebooks and write rows and rows of characters to help you quote unquote remember them.
Yeah, so there's a lot of correction, too. You have to get everything correct, not just your characters, but, everything you say. So often it's not really a focus on communication, like learning to communicate in Chinese, but more on just, like, stop making those mistakes and correct everything. And there's a bit of that chalk and talk or sage on the stage thing where the teacher is, lecturing and you just are supposed to receive it all and then just magically be able to reproduce it on your own.
So there's that. The way I like to position that is it's more that focus on knowledge, right? Acquiring the knowledge as if that somehow equates into proficiency. But yeah, it's the drill and kill, the lecture, you listen to me, and you retain everything I'm saying and do lots of handwriting.
And sometimes these teachers are also a big fan of the HSK because maybe, they're used to educational system, which loves the testing. And so not always, but that may be a sign that the teacher is like super traditional or not so internationally minded.
There's also one other small pervasive element of these types of teachers, and that they'll frequently try to compare you to other students. I don't know if you've ever had this, but this a little bit is a holdover from some of the traditional Chinese educational system, where oftentimes the students are ranked in a class, and they have what, Diiming, right, which is the number one student and things like that, and they kind of get praise in that way.
Okay, so now there might be some learners that sort of like this kind of teacher because they do kind of take control. They hold you accountable. Some people feel like if someone isn't being a taskmaster that they're not even going to get anything done. And some people really do want to learn to write. And, you know, I know people who have said things like, you know, if my mom didn't force me to practice piano from the age of 5 to 15, I would never be an amazing pianist today. And they like thank their mom. So I know there are some people like that. But for a lot of us, this kind of teacher might not be the best introduction to the language.
That's right. And I will say another scenario where I've actually seen this type of teacher and system work well for learners is if they're like in China and they've already achieved maybe at least an elementary level of Chinese, so they're not just like starting out, but they're also very serious learners. Because in that type of environment that we're describing with this super traditional teacher, you are getting a whole lot of knowledge. You're getting a whole lot of input and a lot of knowledge in the language. But then this super motivated learner also spends a lot of time outside of class practicing what they've learned. Because frankly, you don't get a lot of the proficiency and practice and recycling of the language that is really important for fluency development in that type of classroom with that type of teacher. So if you can get it elsewhere, in conjunction with your educational process, then you can actually have some pretty good results. But it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time and a lot of focus to do that.
Okay, so this has been the super traditional teacher. Let's move on to number two, who we're calling the buddy teacher. Okay, so as the name suggests, this is the teacher that really wants to be your friend, frequently wants you to call them by an English name. They really want you to like them. They really want to hang out, like they're your teacher, but they're not just your teacher, right? They want to have a really good relationship with you. They don't want to make you angry or, you know, upset in any way.
Right. So these teachers, but don't get us wrong. It's not like, you know, hey, if you have a friendly teacher or a teacher who likes you or might even, you know, want to do something else with you outside of class, that, you know, they're necessarily a buddy teacher. But I think, you know, there's a few distinct elements of these types of teachers. That I think in general, John, is that they're less professional. You know, they don't really have they're not really prepared. They don't really have a lot of learning goals or kind of understand a lot of, you know, the educational process that can go into learning a language.
Yeah, so a lot of times this is just one step up from a language exchange, like a language corner, and they might even see the lessons as an opportunity to practice their English. This probably drives me crazier than anything else. It's like some people, not everybody obviously, might like not even really expect you to make much progress, so we're just going to be speaking English, right? But they need to expect you to speak Chinese and expect you to do your best to understand, right? But not everybody feels that way.
I think one of the challenges I've had with individuals like this is that if you make a mistake or something, yeah, they don't want to correct you. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not helpful to have every mistake corrected all the time. It gets a little tedious, especially if you are making a lot of mistakes. But if there is no correction, it's just kind of like, oh, I understand you. You know, that's good enough. That's not so helpful, because then you start, you know, reinforcing the mistakes that you're making and they get fossilized and it gets really hard to change later on.
Yeah, I've come across a lot of learners at All Set Learning, and if they've had a lot of teachers like this, then frequently they have no clue, like, if their pronunciation is good or not. Like, they don't realize that they're making these systematic errors, I should say, like, all the time. And it's just because they've had this kind of teacher. And probably one of the most annoying things, if they are kind of this buddy teacher that just kind of likes to chat, that they don't really prepare anything, right? Which is something you really expect your teacher to do. They just come and they're just like, what do you want to talk about today? And this is someone that you're paying.
And it's okay.
This is someone that you're paying often.
It's okay to have a teacher ask, what do you want to talk about? I mean, that's great. It follows your interest. But if that's what's happening all the time or too frequently, then it's kind of, that's a good indicator.
So I think the key here is that this is the buddy teacher, right? So it's good to have friends. You talk to them in Chinese. They're not interested in correcting you. They're interested in, you know, hanging out. And it's good to have a teacher. And the teacher has their role. But when you combine them, you kind of get the worst of both worlds often. I don't know. Maybe some of you feel like you have the best of both worlds. You know, I know some people like marry their Chinese teacher and stuff. But I think that's the exception. I think the buddy teacher could often be a bit of a disaster.
You know, just a little point on that, John, is that I think this whole dynamic that we're kind of talking about here is oftentimes why individuals who might marry or be in a serious relationship with a native-speaking Chinese person also have a hard time as that person being like a tutor or a teacher to them, right? It's because, you know, you have a relationship that's not dependent, per se, on Chinese. And if they're also trying to be your teacher, tutor, trainer, things like that, it creates, at times, unhealthy dynamics in the relationship.
Yeah, and I think it's about accountability. You expect the teacher to hold you to certain standards, and the teacher should also expect a certain amount of effort out of you. So, yeah. All right, so who do we got next?
The know-it-all teacher.
Okay, so this kind of teacher, often they know a lot. They might know a lot about stuff like Chinese history, Chinese culture, and they really want to share it with you. And sometimes they kind of forget that they're trying to teach you Chinese. And they have a hard time keeping the level low enough for you to understand because they want to talk about some topic that they know a lot about instead of what you need to be focused on so you can improve your Chinese.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a key characteristic behind these types of teachers is that they're more interested in looking smart and try to like maybe prove that they're clever or intelligent as opposed to, hey, let's really help you learn.
Yeah, and actually I've seen a variation of this kind of teacher where if they teach an advanced student, you know, someone who's quite fluent already, they still have gaps in their vocabulary and maybe an occasional grammar or tone mistake, but they're quite fluent. This kind of teacher frequently will just go straight to like super hard vocabulary, like, oh, your Chinese is excellent. How about these 10 Cheng Yu? Do you know all these? And the thing is, that's not what you need right now. You need to like focus on I plus one, just slightly higher than where you are now, and you know, improve in those areas. But that's not how this kind of teacher operates, and it's not the best way for you to learn.
Definitely. And so I think some other characteristics of this is that they're oftentimes too quick to help or correct. So like if you are trying to come up with a word or something, then they'll, you know, they immediately fill it in for you. They don't let you struggle and try to like, oh, or how do I say it? And they might, you know, oh, this way. And then they just kind of go on and you know, maybe not even ask you to produce what they had suggested. I think another way too is that sometimes you might say something this way, one way, and they'll also present, oh, you can also say it this way and this way and this way. Oh, and this other word also means the same thing. And so, you know, they've not presented like, you know, they often now have given you 3 to 5 new ways and vocabulary on how to say the same thing. And you're kind of like, I can't process all this right now.
Yeah, that's not helpful. We have another podcast on making your language learning learner-centric. And when a learner is trying to express a certain thing, it doesn't really help to give you 5 words to, you know, do slightly different things that you're not actually trying to say. So, yeah, it should be about communication and not about just multiplying knowledge magically as fast as possible.
Absolutely. And again, John, touching a little more on that comprehensible input. Like, have you ever had this happen with just a native speaker where you ask a question and they just go off, right? And they're just speaking about this and they delve deeper into the subject and they don't even like...
You mean like a non-teacher?
Yeah, a non-teacher. I guess a know-it-all teacher, non-teacher, you know, where they just go on about a subject and maybe they're not even checking in with you to see if you understand. And so, you know, they're not really giving you anything that you can really comprehend or understand about what's going on, and you're just sitting there, you're totally lost, 对, you know? And by the end, they're like, they move on, and they don't even check to see if you knew what they were talking about or anything.
Right. So obviously it's cool to make friends with smart people and learn from your Chinese friends. But if your level can't handle it, then you want to find a teacher who can communicate with you on your level. And so hopefully you can find that kind of teacher and not spend too much time not really learning very much from a know-it-all teacher. Okay, and finally, the teacher, which I hate to call out, but I have to, it's the too nice teacher. And the too nice teacher is just so nice. You don't want to say anything bad about them. They never want to make you feel bad. They never want to call you out. They might tell you to call them by an English name, but it's not because they want you to use an English name because it's cool or whatever. It's because they're afraid that you might mispronounce their Chinese surname and that'll make you feel bad. So they give you an English name just for you so that it's easier for you. You know, this kind of teacher.
Yeah, they're nice teachers. They're great. And that's, I think, one of the things, it's easy to get stuck with a too nice teacher because you're like, oh, but they're so nice and everything. And, you know, you don't want to hurt their feelings by saying, oh, I think maybe I don't want to do lessons or I want a different teacher or something, right? But, you know, I another characteristic of these is that they, you know, we talked about with a buddy teacher, like they're, you know, they're not really correcting you. Well, you know, the too nice teacher, they may like not correct you at all. They just maybe like don't want to hurt your confidence. You know, they just want to be like, you know.
But they're totally noticing your mistakes, but they're not pointing them out, or they only do like when it seems like exactly the right time and it's like, you know, not too egregious or whatever.
Yeah, they could be really encouraging. Oh, great, great. Yeah, that was great. You know, but maybe it really wasn't. So I think that's one of the things about a nice teacher, a too nice teacher, I should say, is that they may actually give you some reinforcement of mistakes, you know, unwittingly. Like you may be making a mistake and they may be like, oh, yeah, that's great. And so you have some false confidence about your language ability.
Yeah, one of the things that I really like when teachers do is when you answer a question or you want to express some idea and you kind of fumble through it and they get what you're saying, but it obviously was not a smooth sentence. And then some teachers will be like, okay, I understood what you just said, but could you say it again a bit more smoothly? Or maybe they give you a little help and ask you to repeat it. And then like you fumble through it a second time and they're like, okay, maybe try that one more time. And so the too nice teacher is not going to do that. They feel like, oh, that's just too much. You know, don't want to hurt his ego. But teachers that do that are really helping you. So too nice teachers, come on.
Yes, and I think that's one aspect, though, of the too nice teachers, that they really want you to be able to like understand, you know, what's going on. And unfortunately, that can lead to them using too much English. You know, surprise, not surprise, you know, a lot of Chinese teachers speak pretty decent English. But some of them will get stuck in that rut of really, like, you know, using English too much in the classroom. And I think, you know, English definitely has its place because at some point, if you're just thrown in full immersion, no English, full Chinese, you're probably going to have a hard time at the very beginning. But there comes to that point of like, what point, you know, is like, hey, we're talking about all this in English as opposed to saying, hey, how much can we actually use in Chinese to help you understand and get you some of that reinforcement and proficiency and practice that you need to really develop your language skills. But yeah, like I said, these two nice teachers, they're going to be using typically a lot of English.
And, you know, their fears are based in something real. It's true that Chinese is maybe not the easiest language in the world to master. And it's true that a lot of people give up. And so this teacher doesn't want to contribute to you giving up because it's too hard. But, you know, them being too nice isn't really helping you in the long run. You want a teacher that's going to push you, going to challenge you so that you'll keep going. And, you know, like I said before, you also want them to hold you accountable. But if they're too nice, it just doesn't happen.
I wonder, too, if these too nice teachers, they might be aware of those very traditionally minded teachers. And maybe they're trying to counteract and, you know, balance those teachers out.
Yeah, so there are some learners that maybe are super self-critical and they're just so full of self-doubt that maybe they need a too nice teacher, at least some aspects of the too nice teacher, because they don't really need to be pushed. They're already so hard on themselves that they might need someone who's a little bit like this. I've seen people like that.
Yeah, totally true. And so I think that even on that note, John, that even all these things we're talking, hey, these are the types of teachers to avoid, there are going to be certain aspects that may work well with you, with your personality, with your style, with your goals, and with whatever else you got going on in life. And also, maybe we just don't have, you may not have access to a number of teachers. So even if you are aware of some of these, you know, things to avoid, you may become more aware of it, and you could sometimes address these with your tutor or your teacher, or you may find other ways to compensate for things that they might be doing.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of learners over the years and a lot of different teachers. And one of the things that continues to surprise me is that I'll have a client who's like, oh, this teacher you have is the best teacher. They're so great. Love them so much. You got to keep that teacher. That other teacher, not so much. But then another client will say exactly the opposite thing for totally different reasons about the exact same two teachers. And so there's no denying that there are best practices and there are, you know, principles of learning, and you want to do the right thing. But, you know, everybody's different and takes different teachers for certain types of learners, for sure.
That's right, John. And I'll tell you what, even if you've got one of these teachers that we're saying to avoid, you can still learn Chinese as long as you have goals and you're working towards it.
All right.
All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion Graded Readers. Today we're talking about a level 1 graded reader that is only 300 characters you need to read this book.
That's right, and this is an adaptation of Jane Austen's classic, Emma.
So this story takes place in relatively modern Shanghai, maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that, 15 years ago. And because it's in that time period and it's set in an office, I know a lot of people like this story because they can learn, you know, like relatively modern, useful Chinese as they're enjoying a classic story.
That's right. And this classic story is something, you know, I got to be honest, John, this one was near and dear to my heart. My wife, Heather, is a huge Jane Austen fan, and we actually have in the acknowledgments in the book, it says, in a truth universally acknowledged that a woman knowledgeable of all things Jane Austen must be one of a good story. If any of you are Jane Austen's fans, you might know that reference. And that's what our inspiration we took in adapting this story to modern day Shanghai, which was a lot of fun. So it follows the basic plot line of Emma, but it's set in, I said, modern day Shanghai, where Emma is now a fashion designer. And a lot of the drama and the romance happens in the workplace. But it's full of intrigue and drama and plot twists as well.
And this ties in a little bit to what we were saying before about the teachers, like using English names, because this is one of our few stories where a few of the characters actually do have English names, because that's super common in China, even in an all-Chinese office.
That's so true. There are some individuals I've known in the workplace where I don't even know their Chinese name. They even give me a business card and it's got an English name on it. I have no idea. There's no characters on it.
All right, Jared. All right, calm down. But the question is, where are they going to get this Emma book?
Oh, the Emma book. Yes, you can go find it on Amazon, iBooks or Kobo, or wherever you get your books. And you can go out there and get it today.
All right.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I guess you could say it's a rave. I just last week I went to Sanya in southern China, and it's like the southernmost island in the southernmost part of China, and it's kind of a beach party vibe over there. Went to this like small surfing town, and I never would have gone there if it weren't for COVID. Because I realized this, because if you want to go to a place like that, then for the same money, you can just go to Thailand or the Philippines. And there's like, you know, better places for scuba diving. And like Thailand, the food is just so good. And, you know, I love Chinese food, but come on. Why would I want to pass up Thai food, right? But because of COVID and all the travel restrictions, we wanted some like tiny little vacation because we've been cooped up for so long this year. So we went to Sanya, and it was kind of nice. And I thought it was cool to see like this, you know, this alternate China, which is all beach centric with surfers and you know, all that. And it was pretty cool.
That's awesome. I've never been there, but I look forward to. I mean, is it worth the trip? Would you recommend it?
Like, if I could choose between Sanya and Thailand, I would always choose Thailand if I could go there, because, you know, it's just a cool country. But Sanya is cool. I do recommend it.
All right. Well, maybe I'll be able to make it there someday if I ever get to make it back to China with all this COVID hullabaloo.
So, Jared, what do you got? Rant or rave today?
All right, I have a rave today.
Jared, this isn't a rave about yourself again, is it?
Kind of. Well, okay, all right. So maybe a little self-serving rave, but here we go. So I actually had the opportunity this week and last week to make a presentation to all of the Chinese teachers here in Utah who are teaching in the Chinese Dual Language Immersion Program. Now, just a little background on this. Utah has more Chinese dual language programs than any other state in the United States. It sounds kind of crazy. It's actually kind of a small state. We only have like 3 million people, but some legislation was passed over a decade ago. It started all these dual immersion programs here in Utah. So there's a lot of teachers, but I was invited to come present and talk to them about the research that we had done, and we talked about on our episode here about the 6 different types of Chinese learners, episode 87, right?
Yep, 87.
It was a great opportunity to do this, and I just always get excited about this. I'm a nerd in this way. I love talking about research, and this was something that was really interesting to me. But I was really glad that the director of the Utah programs, she had reached out to me about this, and she'd seen a presentation I'd made at the National Chinese Language Conference about it and said, hey, could you come and talk to our teachers? And I was really, like I said, really happy about this, because administrators and different teachers are really kind of seeing, and well, they inherently know the importance of learner motivation, but they're saying, hey, we need to pay more attention to this, and we really need to get a better understanding of what is motivating language learners, and specifically Chinese language learners. It's a more difficult language, and there are kids that drop out of these programs after, you know, sometimes being in 4 years or even 8 or 9 years in the program. They drop out, and sometimes they're just not, teachers aren't connecting with different learners. So this was a great opportunity to take some of the research that we've done and hopefully really benefit an educational system. Now, I mean, it's just one presentation, so to speak. But my hope is that, you know, some of these teachers take some of this stuff to heart and are able to now speak more directly to some of the learners out there and hopefully make a better impact and help students find their motivation and find an interest. And I presented a whole lot of the different ideas on how to do that. So anyway, it was a great opportunity to do. And so I had to rave about that because I have a little more, you know, I guess not say more hope, because I always have a lot of hope for the language learners out there and teachers and stuff and educational systems. But hopefully things moving in a better direction with more learners becoming engaged in the classroom.
Yeah, because a big part of what we stand for here is the learner perspective. And so when teachers show an interest in, you know, aspects of the learners that they might not be aware of, then obviously that's a good step towards progress. And it's only going to get better.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talked about that, John. Hey, learner's perspective, you know.
There you go.
Always challenge them. Remember what it was like when you were learning English. You know, when you were young or whatever age and learning English, it says, you know, what was your motivation? And, you know, we need to think about that for their students who are learning Chinese right now.
All right. Well, Jared, thank you for that very rambly rave.
It was rambly.
All right. So let's do that interview.
I'm Brad Johnson. I have been living in China for about the most of the past 10 years. I'm from the DC area in the United States.
Brad reached out to me on social media, you can too, and shared his Chinese podcast with me. That led to this interview.
So I was teaching English in China and kind of do a bunch of freelance stuff now.
Brad's story is a great example of where your interests and passions can lead you in life and how your initial reason for learning Chinese may not be the main reason you decide to take your Chinese learning to new levels. Stay with us. Okay, Brad, why did you start learning Chinese?
I volunteered to serve a mission for my church, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I was planning on being able to serve a Japanese-speaking mission. I had actually learned Japanese in high school for 3 years, and I just thought that would work. I like Japanese. It was fun. But I really had just gotten started. I wasn't that great of a language student back in high school. But turns out that it was chosen for me to go not to Japan, but to California and Mandarin speaking. And I mean, I knew about Japanese, but I didn't even know. I was one of those classic, like, wait, what is Mandarin? Like, I didn't know that it was Chinese. Like, that's where I was starting from.
Just for our listeners, I'm also a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but you don't get to choose this, right? You may say, oh, you may be fluent in Japanese, right? But they may still say, oh, we're going to send you to Mexico or something, right?
Yeah, you say you're willing to go, and you're willing to go wherever you're sent to, and then you can give your experience, is basically what it was, that I have learned Japanese, and I tried to make it sound like I know it, and I want to keep speaking it, please, you know. But obviously, it wasn't what was chosen for me, so... And I was willing to accept that, whatever came. So if it was Croatian, that would have been cool too. But that just really wasn't my plan. So that's kind of why I say, like, that was how I started learning Chinese. And then I was just kind of thrown into it. So, you know, you go to a training center for 3 months, all day, every day. You're training and you're learning the language and you're using Chinese from day one. That was my start as far as the logistics of it. But I feel like the why only came later. Because I was just doing it because I was willing to be there and I wanted to do this service to help people out, but it had nothing to do with Chinese. Like, I was going to do it in whatever language I did.
I like how you're kind of approaching this, because on this podcast, I talk a lot about, like, motivation. Like, why did you start learning? I mean, that's where we start out here. And you kind of told me a little bit of the how, but the why is a little bit like, because you just got thrown in. You were expected to learn.
Right.
But it sounds like your motivations changed somewhere along the way. Maybe some of the elements have started interesting you, but... Was it when you were a missionary, or was it after that time? Were there some specific events where it started to turn for you?
No, I was starting to catch on to how cool and interesting and challenging it was. It definitely started when I was serving my mission, because I was with people from all parts of the world that speak Chinese. I'm careful to say that, because there's maybe 40% of the people I interacted with were from mainland China. A lot were from Taiwan or Hong Kong or Malaysia or other places.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many people that speak Chinese, and the ones that I met were so fascinating that is really what my motivation developed into and focus on, is just as a tool to connect with people. It's not even just like, oh, I love Chinese culture. I love people, and there's 1.5 billion or however many people speak Chinese, and they're all really interesting. So that is really what's kept me going all along, is just being able to understand people who are different from me and different from each other. You know, when I say diversity, as I was in the States all day, every day, I would talk to people from mainland China, from all over China, and from Hong Kong and from Taiwan. Even more so when I went to mainland China and I started to live there, is when I discovered, I mean, Chinese people and also people outside of China, they all just kind of think like those are Chinese people. So if you're Chinese, they say like, this is 我们中国人, like us Chinese people, this is how we think. But as a person who loves to travel, anytime I can, when I'm in China, I go everywhere and I talk to people. And I just love to talk to restaurant owners and shop owners and the guards in my complex. And for me, like, the first time that I really started to realize how diverse and how interesting different people in China can be is just my first love in China was pulled noodles.
Ah,
those la mian shops.
Lanzhou la mian. That's my perennial favorite. It's my favorite dish from China, period.
Yeah. When I just first showed up, started teaching in China in 2011 in Zhenjiang, and it just stood out to me. I saw the owners of this one shop that was near my place. I was like, they're not Chinese. You know, I knew nothing. They just looked different. So I said, I want to talk to them. And just from that experience, my friends and I who were in that town together, we ended up going and eating at that same shop like 4 or 5 times every week for 6 months. To the point where we just became best friends with these people. And eventually, the one kid, his name was Zach. We gave him the English name of Zach. He was 15 years old, probably illegal labor or whatever. He was there with his aunt and uncle. And he was just the coolest kid that I just had to go to his hometown, you know, had to go to see where he was from. So a couple years later, I went to Qinghai and I fell in love with Qinghai and the diversity that's there.
That's pretty cool. Like, so you actually went and visited his hometown, Qinghai.
Yeah.
That's out in the west of China. I forget where it's at.
Yeah, it's like right between Tibet and Xinjiang, basically. The Qinghai-Tibetan Plateau, it's kind of a transitional area, and it's also demographically, I totally fell in love with it out there too, because it's the most diverse place that I've been in China, because they're just from everywhere and there's so much Tibetan ancestry there, and then Mongolian, and there's Hui Muslim, but there's also Salar Muslim and all sorts of people there.
I want to hear a little bit more about this trip to Qinghai, visiting your 15-year-old friend from the noodle shop.
So the big city in Qinghai is Xining. That's the capital. But, you know, he lives in a place called Hualong, which is a 2.5-hour drive outside of the main city. This was a time when, this dates me here, but I had a dumb phone. Like, I didn't even have a smartphone. You know, I didn't have maps or anything to get me. So I had to stop at this city before Xining called Ping An Xian, peace. I get off the train there and I had a phone number, but he never answers his phone. And so I'm just walking around this little town. And it was totally shocking for me too, because every single person that I saw was Muslim. Like, they're all wearing the white skull caps. And it was awesome. Like, I just loved it at first sight. It's the Utah of Qinghai. So it's in the highlands and it's dry. And there's beautiful red rocks everywhere. And
wow.
In the summer, coming from hot Jiangsu, it was just refreshing. But I eventually found him and he didn't have his ID, and so we couldn't go to the bus station. We just had to wait on the side of the road for the bus, and we kept on trying to flag down the buses, and they kept on passing because they didn't have any seats left. And eventually we got on, and I just felt like it was in a foreign country within a foreign country, just because I didn't understand anything that anybody was saying. They're all speaking in Qinghai Hua, or even like Salar is a language of the Salar people there that only 100,000 people speak. We eventually get off the bus, and we have to walk 20 or 30 more minutes to find his home. And it was the first time I had been in the traditional, I don't know if you've ever been to the countryside homes in China where they have like a courtyard.
Yeah.
You kind of enter in the main gate and then their living room is just the outside in the courtyard. And then there's a couple of buildings around. And their home is really cool because his parents are actually both deaf, which was also added another layer of interest. Yeah. And his dad is a carpenter. He was really good with his hands. And so there was all these contraptions all around the house. Like, you pull on like a string on one end and it like opens the door, or like adds wood to the fire or something on the other side.
Like these Rube Goldberg machines, right?
Right. Yeah, it was pretty fascinating. And that first moment when I got there, it was Ramadan. So they were fasting throughout the day. And actually, when we were still in Ning'an in peace before we got on the bus, he assumed that I was hungry, which I was. So like he had me eat, but he wasn't eating. It was kind of embarrassing. But I was like, well, I don't know, and the next time I'm able to eat. So I ate like a huge thing of noodles. But then when we got home, it was just getting to sundown. And I'd only eaten like 2 hours previously. And it was time for their big family meal. And they were starving from the whole day of not eating. Plus, I'm literally the first time an American has been in their town in 20 years. And I'm, you know, the kuchi, like I'm a guest. And there was just so many factors at play and they were starving. I just remember that night was the most stuffed I've ever been in my entire life because they fed me as though I was as hungry as they were. Plus, as a guest, plus the fact that
and
I just...
And you're obligated to eat, you know, you right, got to do it.
Exactly. And I had just eaten 2 hours earlier, so I didn't sleep very well because my stomach had nowhere to put what I had given to it, so... I fell in love with Qinghai and with Northwest China when I went because even though, I mean, with his parents, I didn't know their sign language. I mean, they use like their own version. It's not even really whatever the standard China sign language is. It's whatever they can use with their son to communicate. But just as he was taking me around too, nobody spoke Mandarin.
Really?
Everybody was speaking the local dialects. Because in Qinghai Hua, the Qinghai dialect, it's like a mixture of Tibetan and Salar and the Han Qinghai dialect all kind of mixed together.
Wow.
So I was able to kind of slowly pick up on some things. And then just to the point where, I mean, I went back to Qinghai so many times that I could pretty well understand what they were saying. And then when I would bring Chinese friends with me, I have to translate for my Chinese friends just because I couldn't really speak what they were saying, but I could understand what they were saying.
This is always a good reminder, right, of how diverse this country is. And I've worked in a business over the years and people are like, oh yeah, we're going to go to all parts of China. We're going to expand. I'm like, it's going to be a lot more challenging than you think because this exact situation occurs in many different areas, right, around China.
It's totally different. For one is the dialect, obviously, that's the most obvious, but there's just details that you can find in every corner of China that are always fascinating and different. in just some random little town in Inner Mongolia when I was there. Had never been to Inner Mongolia, so I picked a Bayan-Nawar town to just get off and live in a hotel for a couple of days and experience it. And I've been to, you know, hundreds of Chinese cities, but the only time I ever saw that in that city, everybody rides their scooters everywhere. The way that people did all sorts of advertising there is these IEs, these ladies, would stand at the stoplights with their little flyers. And when people would stop in their scooters at the lights, they would go up to each of their little baskets in their scooters and stick a flyer in there. And that's like such a random little detail, but like it was so in your face. Literally every street corner, there was somebody doing that there. And I've never seen anyone doing that anywhere else in China. So
that's hilarious. Sounds like you've been to many, many places and cities around China. What are some of the other more memorable places that you've been in and why?
Yeah, I have been to all but three provinces. And I kind of have this issue where everywhere I go, I think is amazing and memorable. And I think, oh, I could live here. I love it. That's kind of like an overall memorable thing for everywhere. But, you know, places that I've really loved, for example, I really love Dongbei, just in the northeast. Like Changchun, I love Changchun.
I've been there a few times.
I studied geography and city planning, and I just noticed that it's a little bit different. Like there's just some nuances, just the shape of the streets and the way that houses are arranged and how they face the street is a little bit different. And then dumplings really are totally different in Dongbei than they are anywhere else. The dishes are huge. They call them shizaida, like honest or earnest or whatever. They give you everything that you want.
Healthy portions.
Shenzhen is an interesting one because coming from Hong Kong, which is, you know, this awesome, cool, bright, light city, and my first impression of Shenzhen was like it was just a hot mess. You know, we went over the land border at that Lohu station, if you've ever been there, but like I just thought this place is terrible. Like this is gross. It's dirty. And my first negative impression was like, I knew this was just a city built out of nowhere and these people just came from everywhere. But then over time, as I went back to Shenzhen many times, it became one of my favorite cities because I just took the time to meet different people. And that became my favorite aspect of Shenzhen was the diversity there. You know, people from all over, mostly in the south, the languages and the background and the cuisine and everything. Shenzhen just became my favorite place to go meet people.
Something I'm kind of picking up on here is obviously you really enjoy connecting with people, forming those relationships. But obviously, being able to speak Chinese has been really critical and very important part of that. And for our listeners, we haven't mentioned this yet, but you also have a podcast in Chinese with a Chinese co-host. And I've listened to your Chinese and it's pretty solid. So what do you think have been some of the things that you've done that helped you to obtain such a proficient level of Chinese where you're able to such fluidly converse with people and be able to make those connections that you've always been wanting to make?
As I was on my mission in the United States, I think the key for me was really that it was a place where there was people from all over.
You said that you were a missionary in the United States speaking Chinese.
Yeah, so about 18 months that I was there in this church unit where there was members of our church, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that all spoke Chinese that were immigrants in that area. And every week, we're meeting together in church. I'm meeting their friends and helping to teach their friends and do service projects and everything. You know, San Jose, there's people that are in the Silicon Valley, but there's also just all sorts of people that have either been there for generations, Chinese descendants or newcomers. And so there was just this diverse community of people that I was interacting with all day, every day. Not only the people in my church, but their friends and the people that we would meet on the street. I was learning Chinese with people that were from all over the place. And I really think my strength in my Chinese was just my listening. Mm. And it came from being exposed to different accents of Chinese and people from all different places. I'm thinking of a quote from Kramer in Seinfeld where Kramer has this cough and he's sick and his friends are telling him to go to a doctor. And he's like, I don't know. I don't go to a doctor. I want to go to a vet. Because a veterinarian... In the same day, they got to cure a chicken, a pig, a frog, a cow, a horse. He's like, that's the person I want to see because I think they can handle anything. I was having to deal with a Hong Konger, a Taiwaner, a Dongbei, a Beijinger from Shanghai, whatever. So it was just from that point that I just got good at listening and being able to understand what the message that people are giving without necessarily knowing all the vocabulary. you know, I struggled with reading and writing. That's always been my struggle, is characters. I just decided I would focus on listening and conversation, interacting with people.
Don't worry about reading and characters being a weak spot. That's
yeah, I know, it's
same for everyone, right?
But like, I feel like it's like really my weakness, like real bad. I didn't learn for 2 years. I didn't learn any characters.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And even when I went to school after university, I took a couple of Chinese classes and I gave up. I couldn't do it. The characters were just too much for me. There's hope, though. There's hope, because as I persevered and focused on just connecting with people, just kind of by like osmosis, as I moved to China too, like you can't not pick up on the characters, and to the point where now I'm pretty confident, you know, I can text and type and read everything that I need to read. But it's always been a oral thing for me, like listening, speaking. That's just my personality and my strength. Anyway, in English too, like I'm just a slow reader.
I appreciate that perspective, because I mean, you're not alone. There's other people in that same boat, right? They just feel more comfortable speaking. And something I have seen is that if you go to the point where you're able to say certain things, or you're able to speak, and maybe your characters aren't very strong, by that simple point of like typing out like a sentence and pinging, the predictive text of what you're actually trying to say is really good. And so you're kind of like, well, let's just go ahead and say yes. These are the characters that are probably most likely the ones that I mean from what I'm trying to say. And it comes out, and usually it's right, or well, most of the time, right?
Those predictive text engineers, whoever they are some of my best Chinese teachers, my character teachers, because that's how I've learned most of my characters, is just by like, I know the pinyin, and that must be what I'm trying to say. So ideally, it'll be confirmed by A, the person understands what I mean, and B, the same day or a couple days later, somebody will type the same thing back to me. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's what I said. And that's...
Yeah, that's right.
Sounds like what I meant it to be, so it must be right.
不错. It's good. We'll take it. My early days of Chinese, I did learn a lot of characters by typing in QQ. So you were talking about having dumb phones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was in QQ days, so that's pre-WeChat.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I still have my QQ number memorized.
You said almost 10 years in China. Now you're back in the States. I know COVID's impacted you quite a bit. So what are you doing to keep Chinese relevant in your life?
Well, I guess I cheat, because I do a podcast and I do translation work. So it's not only relevant to my life, it's just necessary in what I do every day. But even if I wasn't doing, as far as my work or my hobbies that I was doing every day, all day, every day, I would still be in contact with my Chinese friends, because I just was there for so long. And that's kind of just where my network is, and my web of people, and just the things that I'm concerned about and the people that I'm concerned about day in and day out are there. So again, it's all about the connections with people. There's great material out there, but nothing is better than just a Chinese friend that you can just connect with. Because language is hard and you're struggling with your Chinese, but it doesn't matter if you're connecting with somebody. And then by the fact that you are connecting with this person who speaks Chinese, then your Chinese is going to follow.
Brad, I want to know a little bit more about this whole literacy aspect. You say you took some classes in college, some Chinese classes, and the characters felt like, ah, you say you like want to just give up. And maybe, I don't know if you did give up or whatever, but maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because we all go through some of those hard patches. But you also, looking at the point now where it sounds like, hey, you know, you're very comfortable and be able to handle written Chinese texts and reading and things like that, albeit you say your reading's maybe a little slower. That's okay. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that experience and what was that like for you and what helped you kind of eventually persevere?
Yeah, the apex of my struggles, so I guess that's the opposite of apex, whatever that is, the valley of my struggles was when I took a calligraphy class at college.
Oh.
And man, like, A, I'm not an artist. Characters are not art, but calligraphy, you definitely have to have control over your hand movements. Yeah. And B, it's just like focusing, it's just cherishing everything about Chinese, which is like the worst part of Chinese for me, just the structure of these words and these characters. So frankly, like, I did give up because of that class in a way, because it killed me. Like, we would just have the simplest assignment to write a character the way that we had learned it and make it look good. And I just couldn't do it. Not only could I not make it look good, but mentally I couldn't really process the character that I was writing. And I just remember like yelling at my hand, saying like, you know that you can speak Chinese and you can tell somebody, oh yeah, this is Wei Chi the Wei, but like the Wei itself, that character, means nothing to you and it's your enemy. I just got so angry at my hand and at Chinese characters that I just gave up. And by gave up, I mean I didn't try that hard in the class and I got a D or something and just didn't take any Chinese classes after that. That also, though, kind of was the key to unlocking my later growth and appreciation of Chinese characters and just of the structure of the Chinese language in general. Because by taking that calligraphy class, I did learn all the details of, first of all, the stroke order and just the physical structure of how you lay out a character in the space.
The form and the process, right?
Thank you. As I was no longer forcing myself in an academic situation and getting frustrated with the characters, I was able to go back to just the beauty of Chinese characters separate, again, from academic, from a class. What I love so much about Chinese is that, like in English, good writing, we think that we have to be wordy to express a beautiful idea or a complicated idea. But in Chinese, often like less is more because the meanings of like any character, you know, most words are two characters. And so when you have those two characters together, you're carrying in the meaning of all of the other words that those two characters are in and putting them together and like creating a new meaning from those two characters. As I was starting to pick up characters by osmosis because it wasn't working any other way, to start to unlock those little secrets, those details that are just so deep and so beautiful, it was totally mind-blowing to me. And now I don't hate characters. I still can't write them very well, but I'm totally motivated now to explore and find, you know, discover these nuances.
What you're touching on there is almost the beauty of Chinese poetry. It's very concise, but packed with meaning, right? Because like you said, those characters that are used are associated with other characters and carry nuances. And it's not something to really learn by, but it's once you get to a level, it's something you can definitely appreciate.
Yeah.
Brad, there are other people listening who are probably in the exact same boat that you're describing. They may be going through this very experience right now. Looking back and having gone through what you've gone through, what would you say to someone who's going through that same experience right now and that struggle with characters?
I would say free yourself from the guilt of my Chinese teacher or somebody on Reddit said, you need to focus on these characters or otherwise you're not really learning Chinese. The nice thing about that is when you do let that go, then you can actually go back and in your own way, you can pick those things up just over time in a way that works for you. Like a couple of years ago, I picked up the Chinese Harry Potter, you know, on one of those reading apps. I thought, oh, yeah, this'd be easy. Like, I know Harry Potter, and it's like a kid's story, right? So I thought it'd be easy. This is before I knew about Mandarin Companion and about a graded reading. I just thought, you know, I can do this. Basically, I've been reading, quote unquote, the Chinese Harry Potter for 2 years. I just barely got through the first broom flying lesson. So, it's taking me forever. Like the vocabulary is all mystical magic words and translations of names and whatever. So it just took me forever to pound through it. And I just thought like, I should be doing this, but I eventually realized like, that's not the way to go. So I just put it aside and didn't worry about it. Then a gift from heaven came when a couple of months ago, all of a sudden on Shimalaya, this big podcasting app, they came out with the full recorded audiobook of the Harry Potter.
Oh, nice.
Because a lot of times Chinese audiobooks, they like overproduce them. I don't know, cheesy. And this one is highly produced. Like there's music and sound effects and everything, but it's really good. It was done in conjunction with Pottermore. So I guess I am plugging them, even though Harry Potter was emblematic of the wrong way to do it, was just like forcing yourself to do something that's hard for you and just thinking like, oh, I'll just get through it eventually. Eventually came around and it's like now I either listen to it or sometimes I listen and read along too. And I'm learning at 8 times the speed, the vocabulary and the characters that are in that book because I've finally learned to just not force it, basically.
Oh, that's great. So, Brad, you do podcasts in Chinese. Are there any good podcasts or any resources that you would recommend for Chinese learners? And also recognizing that, you know, we have a wide range of people. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff out there for advanced people, but also people maybe intermediate and lower levels. What's out there that you're aware of?
Yeah. Well, there's a podcast called You Can Learn Chinese. It's really good.
It's a great show.
This is my favorite Chinese learning podcast per se. Again, like for me, it's all about content and connecting with ideas. That's so much more meaningful to me than like we're going to learn how to order a cup of coffee and go through the vocabulary and say it. Basically, if you search stories in Chinese, there's a couple of really good ones.
Mm.
It's narrative. Mm. That's kind of the advantage of a graded reader, a Mandarin companion, is, you know, you're focused not on just pounding out the vocab, but you're getting a story out of it. You're learning lessons. And if you just search on any podcast app, Chinese stories. But speaking of the podcast app, there's, in my opinion, the greatest thing out there, the bee's knees, the life-changing app is called Xiaoyu Zhou. Like I see on Reddit and the Chinese language subreddits and stuff, you know, what are the good Chinese podcasts? What do you guys listen to? Pretty much the only recommendation is, oh, Gusher FM, Story FM is good. And people know that one. One of my friends is one of the producers, but it's heavy. And I mean, it's high level, obviously, but it's also just like depressing most of the time. But I mean, the stories are, you know, human stories. And so they're depressing. But in Xiaoyu Zhou, it is the world of Chinese podcasting now.
I guess we can put a link in the show notes for anyone who wants to check some of these out.
Yeah. They have a really good system of, you know, like a social aspect of it, the commenting, and you can connect directly with the hosts of podcasts and everything. There's so much more out there than people are aware of.
Oh, that's great.
Strong recommendation for Xiaoyu Zhou. Yeah.
So many things out there. So, well, yeah. Brad, what kind of advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now? Maybe they're just even starting out or somewhere along that path.
The biggest mistake I ever made was I didn't buy another little tiny pocket notebook when I ran out of space in my first one. It was leaning into my strength, which is like, I'm okay when I don't understand the words that are being said because I can perceive what they're getting at. But I've been learning Chinese, quote unquote, for 18 years. But my vocabulary level is way, way too low.
Mm.
And as a longtime learner in advanced levels, that's a burden. But my personal focus for 3 months, all day, every day, was just on tones and pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
In the training center I was in, they gave us this chart and an actual cassette tape and a player to follow along to the chart, where the guy just goes through each pinyin spelling and different sounds and then like the tones for each one and just repeating over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I pounded that out for 3 months, every day for hours, 2 or 3 hours. And that to me was like a springboard where from that point on, like I just never struggled to understand the words that were coming out of people's mouths. And I was always able to write down what I heard. It's hard because tones are a struggle and sometimes the reality is that some people's tones just come easier than others, and it's just not fair. Life isn't fair. But if you can get the tones, it just makes a huge difference.
Mastering the fundamentals, there's definitely a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Brad, if people want to find a little bit more about you and also find your podcast, where can they go?
I have two podcasts that I've been doing for a while, and the website is called mianbao.fm, as in like bread, bread.fm. Mm-hmm. It comes from my students called me Brad because Brad sounds like bread and it's funny for Chinese people, I guess. So Mianbao FM is where I have my two different shows. One is called Bread Toast Chinese. It's kind of directed towards Chinese learners more. And then my main one that I'm spending a lot of time with these days is called Jingdi Zhihua. It's the proverb, Jingdi Zhihua is like the frogs in a well, meaning, you know, they look up and they only see the sky above them.
I think that's the world, right?
Yeah. But it's a play on words where the final wa is wa jue de wa, like digging. So like the point is you got to dig yourself out of that well that you're in.
We'll also put a link in the show notes so if anyone wants to be able to find you. Brad, thanks so much for taking the time and sharing these stories and your experience with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks. This has been fun. Go listen to podcasts. Go get Xiaoyu Zhou. I'm serious.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, artists, graduate, traveler, camper, boater, pilot, barista, officer, runner, and that one guy named Lloyd. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Tag us on social media, #mannercompanion. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo. I'd like to thank our special guest, Brad Johnson, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Passy. See you next time.